story.
I don't want to see it. I'm just curious whether you're going to instinct or...
No, I certainly have been through it. And you can keep this. You don't have to look at it. You don't want to even have it. All right.
I think it is better if nothing that I were to say now or later is in any way colored by what's in there. I think I'll leave that to you. But I was just curious whether you have actually seen it by now.
I'm just testing. 1, 2, 3. Here's your...
Okay.
Your mic. And it's on. It should be... It stays on it.
There.
Okay.
Well, I was thinking of doing a human interview than one as an administrator, but I realized I talked to John Ross on props and realized we really hadn't talked about what, how you felt about Madison.
Did you weren't at the final regents meeting?
No.
You would have no reason to be there. I did something there that I had been planning for some time, and I think it came off as I had hoped. I had two old prints, which I'm going to bring in tomorrow. They've been framed. One is a remarkable print of Bascom Hall, then I guess called University Hall, and North and South Hall, and that's all it was, in 1851 from a Boston picture magazine called Gleason's Pictorial Weekly from September 1851. And it has a marvelous text. I'll give you a copy of the statement because it has, I quoted the text in there, and since the print is now at home, I can't get to that directly, but I think you'll see what it does. Then the other is from a print or a picture magazine from the 1870s or 80s, which has two Madison pictures. Science Hall by then was up. That would be early 80s, I guess. But also has pictures of State Teachers College Platteville, State Teachers College, or Normal School, I guess it was still called, Normal School River Falls, Normal School Whitewater, and Normal School Oshkosh, all on the same page in the 1880s. And I said, these two prints really capture for me the essence of how I see the whole university system, that there is a preeminent research institution at Madison, which this text is marvelous. Maybe, I don't want to go get it now, but I will later. The text says, bear in mind this is 1851, with the prospect of reasonable support from the state legislature, this promises to become the premier institution of the Northwest. Now bear in mind that Indiana University was founded in 1820 and the University of Michigan in, was it 44 or 46? So this was not by any means the oldest, but in a sense the first of what were, well, in a one of the first of what eventually became state universities. And that's really what the point that I tried to convey. So I'll give you a copy of the text and you'll see if that fits at all.
And that is about UW-Madison.
Well, but also the relationship. That it is a now, and really has been since 1956, a multi-campus university. There is a little joke which I think someday somebody may appreciate. In January 1981, we learned first of E.B. Fred's death. someone looked out the window after news had come. The flag on Bascom Hall was still at full mast. Someone called over to the Chancellor's office and said, "Why have you not lowered your flag? Do you not know of President Fred's death?" Answer, "Yes, but he was a system person. You lower your flag." E.B. Fred retired 13 years before anyone really thought seriously about a multi-campus system. But in a technical sense, that statement is correct, because it was during his administration that Milwaukee developed as a separate campus. Thus, by the time E.B. Fred retired, the critical decision to make this a multi-campus institution had clearly been set in motion. And I think that point is sometimes lost. The second set of critical decisions, of course, were made about a decade later by Fred Harrington, not only to recognize, not only to enhance the stature of Milwaukee by having there a chancellor to match the chancellor at Madison, but also to develop Green Bay and Parkside and to create a separate extension. In some sense, the decision to separate extension from Madison campus may have been more significant in terms of developing a multi-campus system than the decision to develop Green Bay and Parkside. I say that because even in multi-campus systems, there is only one other in which all of extension is possibly separately administered, and that's Maryland. The University of Maryland has a chancellor for University College, and University College is all continuing education. But even at Maryland, cooperative extension is a part of the College Park agricultural education program. There is no other multi-campus system with the degree of separate identity for extension which existed here from 1966 to July 1st, 1985. So you see, one of the significant things that we have done just this month is to reintegrate aspects of extension which in 1966 were totally separate. Now that reintegration is not quite as centripetal as some might have hoped. For example, much of the Management Institute went to Milwaukee, as I think most people agreed it should. These are people who provide continuing education for the Milwaukee business community. Not all of Management Institute went to Milwaukee, but most did. There were small degrees of integration with other campuses. The bulk of the people beyond co-op, beyond agriculture, home economics, and the few other fields where there is now cooperative extension, that is basically continuing education, professional continuing education people, are Madison-based and therefore Madison-integrated. But I do think it is important and often missed that the decision in 1966 to create a separate extension statewide had profound implications in terms of structure, just as the decision in 56 to create a separate Milwaukee campus had profound implications. Those are decisions that the single campus, the truly single campus institutions, of which there are very few, never made. But they're also decisions which were never made by the single state university campuses with satellites. For example, Michigan, Ohio State, Washington, Oregon. There aren't many. Michigan State, Iowa State, Iowa. That's pretty near the roster of completely freestanding state universities never made. At that time, of course, a few like Virginia went the opposite way and spun off formerly separate branches. And a few, Oregon, Washington, never had them. Michigan, Ohio State are what I would call the satellite structure. Flint and Dearborn, Mansfield, Marion, Piqua, so on, don't really complicate the picture. So.
This wasn't done, however, at Madison's behest. I don't think they were ever very much in favor.
Probably not. It would be fascinating to go back to 56. I've always wanted to do this and to see how much consciousness there was that a major urban campus was in the making, which would someday have doctoral programs, would eventually have the only school of architecture in the state, so on. I don't know how much of that was appreciated. There were some lessons which were important, the most significant of them being Colorado. One of the great ironies is that the president who refused to develop, and to this day there has not developed a strong Denver campus, was Quig Newton, who was for many years mayor of Denver and then became president of the University of Colorado, despite his years as mayor.
What Dreyfus says you can't do is go backwards into
yeah,
academia.
Well, it's Quig Newton is for me one of the really fascinating figures of public higher education. But a person as perceptive in all other ways as Herman Wells was very slow to develop Indianapolis. Frank Rose was very slow to develop Birmingham. And what you have to this day in Denver, Birmingham, and Baltimore, those are the notable examples, are rather stunted, partial urban campuses.
Like Milwaukee?
No.
You don't think so?
No, on the contrary, no. Milwaukee, Chicago, UCLA, well, I won't try to name them all, but those are the prime examples of comprehensive urban campuses that were developed right.
But from the point of view of Madison, Milwaukee is perhaps stunted is too strong a word, but it's not the strong.
No, but. Last week, the president of Fudan, the only woman among the Chinese university presidents, a person with a master's degree from Smith and a PhD from MIT in 1951. Now, how many American women were getting PhDs in physics from MIT in 1951, let alone Chinese? She's now in her mid-60s, of course, but she's one of the real survivors in Chinese education, and her university is clearly one of the major forces. She was very pleased to have a delegation from Milwaukee. Frank Horton, Norma Reese, and others went to sign an agreement with Fudan. Most of the agreements are with Madison, but she said, no, for us at Fudan, it's very useful to have the agreement with Milwaukee. So we recognize it's not Madison. We've had ties with Madison for many years, but we value the relationship with Milwaukee. Now, this is somebody who's very savvy about American higher education. So Now, I would also argue in political terms that with one exception, there is no state university which is either not located in a principal city or has a branch in the principal city that has fared really very well. And the exception is the University of Michigan. Some would say Ann Arbor is close enough to Detroit that they are able to take advantage of that proximity. But if the University of California had decided to turn its back on Los Angeles, I think the Berkeley campus today would be about half what it is in fact. And that's something that eventually people like Quig Newton and his successors in Colorado, Herman Wells in Indiana, Frank Rose in Alabama, began to realize that with the advent of reapportionment of state legislatures, among other forces, that probably only the University of Michigan was going to be able to maintain that kind of momentum without strong ties to a principal city in Washington, in Ohio, and in Hawaii. You don't have to worry about it because the state university is in the principal city. Well, some might say Cleveland is, but Columbus is a very large state capital. So I think it's a political necessity, if nothing else. And even E.B. Fred in 1956 saw that political necessity. Fred Harrington saw it even more clearly and greatly enhanced the role of Milwaukee. Now, as I'm sure you know, Fred Harrington, I think I mentioned this last time, and I hope someday somebody can follow it up. Fred Harrington also saw the importance of developing stronger ties in the West. Mm-hmm. And that was why the Harrington-Haas connection is so important.
Well, my questions today have to do with Madison specifically and its position, how you actually view its position in the system. And the reason I ask this is that there's a great deal of pussyfooting, people hesitating, not wanting to say second-class universities. On the other hand, there are the remarks of Madison's being elitist and arrogant. The fact is that we're all used to inequality and in particular contexts, and that Madison is different from the other colleges. Is this something that you accept and agree with?
Oh, I've said that many times.
Yes, I'm
in
sure
fact,
you have.
Most recently at the Regent meeting, I said we have at the heart and center of this university system one preeminent research university. And then we have other institutions, one of which also offers doctoral degrees and has considerable eminence. I do think sometimes, not on a rank and file basis, but on a collective basis, there is difficulty coming to terms with Milwaukee because nobody knows quite where it stands. When I say not on an individual basis, I mean that people in the Madison English Department, for example, recognize that Milwaukee, well, the English Department is a strange collection of interesting people. It adds up to being an English department that is rated nationally higher than Vanderbilt, Tulane, University of Missouri at Columbia, and three or four other AAU University English Departments. Now, that's something that...
Yeah, that's fine, but I don't deduct from Milwaukee. I'm really, really talking about Madison.
Yeah,
and you do say it's preeminent.
I think in most fields, it has been and remains. There are some fuzzy areas like architecture, but when we were developing the PhD in architecture, we went to Steve Bourne and others here to make sure that they were comfortable having the professional degree in the professional graduate degree in architecture in Milwaukee. And there was no difficulty. Mm-hmm. I suspect there might be areas in which, well, I'll give one. I have strenuously resisted, and I hope my successor does, converting the degree Doctor of Engineering, which Milwaukee has given for some time, into a PhD in engineering. That's a distinction with which everybody seems quite comfortable. And that's one of the reasons why I resisted the PhD in nursing. We tried very hard to get the Milwaukee people to accept a doctor of nursing or doctor of nursing science. There is such a degree. Unfortunately, the momentum in the profession is all the other way, and a lot of DNS or DSN degrees have been converted to PhD in nursing. So we were really swimming upstream on that one. But the analogy that I used is engineering. And that's a distinction which I believe the Madison engineering people are entirely comfortable with. The Milwaukee engineering people chafe somewhat, but I have told them on several occasions that I think it is appropriate to have a PhD in engineering at Madison and a doctor of engineering at Milwaukee, implying that it is a more applied degree. Mm-hmm. It is not intended as a research and teaching degree in the same way. And that's where things came to rest. Now, several years from now, I think that issue will be reopened. And eventually there may be pressure on regents and others to make the change. Educationally, I think this is the right way to have it.
Well, what I'm curious as to whether it ever occurred to you when you were starting off this job, you were the first non-Madison-based president, and you could come in here as somebody not identified with Madison, whether you could have, in your inaugural address, for instance, said, here we are, a state system with a preeminent research university and other four-year campuses, and somehow persuaded the regents, the chancellors, that it wasn't going to always be them fighting for equality with Madison, because it wasn't legitimate.
Well, I think that's essentially what I said, with one exception. I said that Van Hise was wrong in trying, as he did quite vocally, to prevent the state teachers' colleges from offering any degrees outside education. That was as wrong as Quig Newton not being willing to recognize the reality of the city and county of Denver. And that's the only thing I think I said in the inaugural address that's inconsistent with
You never mentioned Madison in your inaugural address. You spoke of the proud tradition, but
yeah,
you didn't say anything about
I had said on other occasions, and I'm not sure why I did not see any particular place for that statement in the inaugural address, but I guess I would look at this issue more in terms of actions and results than in terms of statements. For example, some of the things we had to do on the salary issue. I had to go to every one of those campuses and to say, and people would ask, say, is the differential justified? And I said, yes, it is justified, and it may increase. And
did
it may increase.
Understand?
No. And finally, just to illustrate the kind of thing that happened, as someone stood up and started shouting at me at Oshkosh He said, you don't understand about teaching, which is what we do here. He said, I'll bet you have never taught 12 hours a week. I said, when I was a full-time law student for 3 years, I taught 15 hours a week. And that ended that discussion. But then I went on to say, as a matter of fact, I happen to be one of the few people around here who, before serving 10 years as a faculty member at Berkeley, actually taught at San Francisco State when it was still San Francisco State College. So I am one of the few people around here who knows something about both sides of the street. And I have some feelings that both kinds of institutions can and for the most part do coexist. That's one area. The second area, if you will look at the biennial budget, this is one of the kinds of things that I think ought to come to light someday, but I just assume not have it put forth tomorrow. We have rather carefully shaped the biennial budget requests in terms that de facto give strong Madison preference. For example, we put a lot into libraries. Mm-hmm. Now, the ratio of current budget support, Madison University cluster, far exceeds any ratio of numbers of people or even of total budgets. Mm-hmm. So if you emphasize library support, then you have de facto a calculus which will yield differential Madison benefit. And that's a very conscious policy that we have used in shaping the biennial budget requests.
Yeah, I don't think anybody argues that you haven't done a great deal for Madison. All I meant was, wouldn't it be possible for the chancellors, at least of the other institutions, not to feel that they're being put in second class seats? Or maybe they don't feel that way.
Well, they will privately acknowledge. One remarkably lucid moment during one of those salary discussions, David Jowett, who was the faculty rep from Green Bay, turned around to his colleagues in the presence of Peter Eichmann, who I must say played a very statesmanlike role in all this during the past year, and he said, look, this was addressed to his university cluster colleagues, we ought to stop this beating up on Madison. Most of us got our degrees there. That's where we go when we need library materials. That's where we send our best students for graduate school. Let's face it. And a lot of people, in the privacy of a closed session, nodded. Mm-hmm. And that sort of stopped the discussion. But then the moment a reporter asks one of those people outside the room, did you accept a differential? They have got to say, no, we are not second class, so on. But in the privacy of that room, that's what they are able to acknowledge, but they can't do it outside.
It's strange that it can't be done publicly.
Now, I have often wondered, why is it so difficult? I've asked people in the California State University system, for example, why did you so readily accept a 13-9 differential in salary catch-up? Well, I've gotten this answer from a number of people. They say, well, we are two separate systems.
Yeah, you said
and,
that.
And, yeah, we recognize they have special needs. Besides, as long as we get our 9%, we're doing okay.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the context. But I think publicly it's very difficult for university cluster people in this state to accept those differentials. I assume that in some way they were actually told in the period 1970 or 71 to 73 that they would be made at least equal to Green Bay and Parkside, if not equal to Madison and Milwaukee. Now, no one in California ever told the state college and university people that they were going to be equal in any way.
Yeah.
That was never an expectation.
That, yeah.
So I guess I would say that I know of no other state in which that expectation has ever been created, as apparently it was. I don't know who created it, whether it's Pat Lucy or Lee Dreyfus or who created it, but somehow, much more when I first went around on my first set of visits in the spring of 1980, I got a great deal of that. They said, when will our teaching loads be reduced to 9? And I had to say, they will not be reduced. It's not in the cards. Then later I could point out to them that Green Bay by that time had moved the teaching load up close to 12. Parkside never did. Parkside remains at 9. But Green Bay actually has gone up to 12. It's partly their eclectic curriculum and having one course in hundreds of different areas. But Parkside never exceeded the 9.
Well, I have some questions having to do with specific issues. This one is the amount of equalization that should be done by the system, and specifically the case of academic staff. I guess people in the Madison campus feel that there's a sort of will to law and order up here, which doesn't take into account the functions that I'm sure you've heard all of this argued, but I'd be curious as to what you do think about it.
Well,
it may not be your policy. Yeah,
whoever made the decision to put the clinical health science people in academic staff, for example, is madness. And that's a lot of what creates the problem. Many of the Madison academic staff, in fact, those who have been, I think, most seriously disaffected, are people who, they're certainly not the clinical physicians. I don't think they're the research staff by and large, they're the librarians and the counselors and so on. In other words, the people who perform academic staff functions very much like the academic staff functions performed at the other campuses.
Well, I think I'm thinking of the faculty. They're feeling that they have to have a flexibility and hiring academic staff and then what they pay them and how long they have to keep them.
The impetus for all that is legislative. There was signed last week a bill which mandates a structure, not only a study, but in effect a structure. We've resisted that as strenuously as we could.
You, all of you did.
Oh, we testified against it. Oh, sure.
Not,
yeah.
Even in Catherine Lyon.
Oh, sure.
Also.
Yeah. Yeah, but I see Howard Fuller believes that all academic staff should be classified. Mm-hmm. He has some support from the governor and a lot of support from legislators.
Well, why is it the perception in the faculty, Madison, that the system is involved in this too?
Because we did a study trying to explain to the regents that there were enormous, go back and read Catherine's studies. It was in 6 parts, and a theme that runs all the way through that study is that there are great differences in the functions and responsibilities of academic staff which justify differences in job description and so on. But we've had 2 kinds of pressures. One is from outside people who served on the academic staff salary study committee. We had 2 personnel managers from outside. They were just shocked. They said, you mean, it doesn't mean the same at River Falls? You don't have the same salary and the same hours and everything you do at Madison? I said, that's crazy. You can't justify that.
This is your committee.
Yeah,
is
as the committee? People from not WPNL, I think it's Madison Gas. Very good personnel people.
Who put them on?
We appointed them because we thought we should have a couple of private sector people from outside.
Huh.
But as they look, and I think you'd get this from any personnel manager from anywhere, they find absolutely indefensible such differences. Well,
it's too
many,
late to throw them off.
Some regions, they're just two voices. I think many regents feel that way. And I must say, in terms of those who have raised most of the problems, you can justify different treatment of a, let's say, an East Asian or Slavic cataloger, but a person who works at the reference desk, can you really treat that person differently at Madison River Falls? I think that's questionable. A departmental undergraduate advisor, a financial aid counselor.
You think there'd be no difference?
I think justifying
somebody in the economics department here advising students.
Advising undergraduates, I think it's hard to justify. The differences come in what are the bulk in numbers of the Madison academic staff, who do perform functions unique to a research university.
Well, but also the size of the departments they're dealing with. I mean, you have 60 faculty and thousands of students.
But I think that's just a matter of scale, if the ratios are roughly the same. And when it comes to a library, the catalogers, the subject and area specialists, are unique to a large research library. But the public service people, I think that's questionable.
So, and will these the categories that are unique, will they be kept so, do you think, or are
I think so, although the solution, which I have urged time and again on my Madison campus colleagues, I have even used the analogy of the seizure of the embassy in Tehran. I have said, get those people out of the embassy before they become hostages. And by that, I meant the clinical health science and as many of the research staff as possible.
Where would they put them?
It'd have to create a separate category, which wouldn't be all that difficult. Call them clinical professor.
I see, which is just what was being suggested, in fact.
Yeah, the decision, the treatment of the clinical health science as, or what, it always seemed to me the most extreme case, visiting faculty, holding tenured appointments at another university. They become academic staff while they are here. Now, the answer is, well, we only have three categories. I don't read the statute as being quite that restrictive. And I think if they
had... So you think they can help themselves then?
Well, I've never had a good answer to that suggestion.
And to whom have you made it?
Herb Shane, Bri Curl, Bernie Cohen. If any of them are honest, they will acknowledge the analogy to the hostages.
Uh-huh.
That goes back 3-4 years. Now, I don't mean that it would be easy, but if there were real concern, for example, about their being trapped in a bargaining unit. I'm not just worried about classification, but in a bargaining unit. I think collective bargaining for academic staff is fairly likely. They also, I think we, all of us, tend to feel uniquely put upon by the tripartite classification. In Virginia, there are only two classifications. There are classified, and there are faculty, so that everyone who is not classified must be faculty. Now, in a sense, that creates one set of problems, but it also solves another.
Yeah.
So that a financial aid counselor, for example, has to be given the title Assistant Professor General Faculty if the position is not classified.
Mm-hmm.
That turns out to create fewer problems than it might seem. I just don't think there's been much creative analysis of academic staff problems. And I have been singularly unsuccessful, despite what I thought was a fairly dire threat of having visiting faculty, ROTC, clinical health science. I guess we don't regard emeritus faculty as academic staff because there's no salary. But having those three categories locked into a bargaining unit, I really, I guess I would say that's been one of the few things that I feel is a failure is to get people to face up to the inadequacy of the taxonomy of academic staff, and then more particularly with reference to the former state universities, although not exclusively, to get them to face up to the status of academic staff. I don't know how many times I've said, try treating them like human beings for a while and see what happens. And as I say, that is more, much more addressed, particularly to Stout and Eau Claire, okay, where the second class status is acute. There are departments at La Crosse, a majority of the full-time teaching members of which are academic staff. And that, to me, sounds like South Africa.
All right. Well, I want to get back to Madison now. Madison has faculty governance, which other campuses don't have to that extent anymore.
No, I think that is a false impression. I have attended faculty senate meetings at every campus, and I think there's a lot of mythology, which goes back to McPhee's time. I gather the old WSU presidents really did not tolerate much faculty governance. But
I'm leading, or maybe it's mistaken, but it leads up to the point about whether the system imposes policy, as for instance in the subject of athletics, on all the campuses, or leaves it, in the case of Madison, to the faculty, which is used to handling this. Have you had anything to do with this?
Well, of course, it's got to be, there's got to be some balance. Athletics, actually, the source of faculty governance in athletics is not the Faculty Senate at all. It's the original charter of the Western Conference, which is the Western Conference of Faculty Representatives.
But the faculty here feels that it can be in charge.
Yeah, but that's not, it doesn't come from the Faculty Senate. That was actually imposed from without by the original charter. For example, there are many universities, University of California, for example. I served many years in the Berkeley Senate. I was chairman of the Academic Freedom Committee. And I would put Berkeley faculty governance up against anybody else's. In fact, in personnel matters, the Berkeley Senate plays a much stronger role than do the divisional committees here. But the Berkeley Senate has next to nothing to say about intercollegiate athletics. Why? Because Pac-10 simply has a different structure. The chancellor or somebody in the chancellor's office did all the intercollegiate athletics, and that never bothered me. My point, in other words, is that the source of the strong role, this is not an opinion, this is a fact, the source of the strong role of faculty governance in intercollegiate athletics has nothing to do with the Faculty Senate here at Michigan or Illinois or anywhere else, any more than the rather small role represents any abdication on the part of Berkeley, UCLA, Stanford, SC. It's just a difference in the structure of the conference.
Oh, should I drop the question then?
Because no, I think it's an interesting one because it represents a misperception.
As I understood it, I don't think this had to do with the Hirsch, but it may have, the whole Elroy Hirsch problem, is that the faculty is in charge of the athletics board and could say, shape up and
I think that's true, but
and they feel that the system is imposing a different kind of rule. But I'm very hazy on this.
Yeah, I think that all that I ever did in that area at the direction of the regents was to propose the creation of a committee of chancellors to review policies on fundraising. Fundraising has very little to do with, I'd like to know where that came from, but what I've pursued is a more basic misperception. I would be willing to bet that 90% of Madison faculty believe that the Faculty Senate is somehow the source. The other 10% are people like me who've taught at Berkeley or Stanford or UCLA. and realize that PAC-10 is quite different. Okay. Even though I hope everyone here would accept the notion that Berkeley and Stanford and UCLA faculty governance is as healthy as it is here, but has almost nothing to do with athletics. It's just a different approach, which comes from the basic charter of the conference. The Western Conference is a conference of faculty representatives. The PAC-10 is a conference, basically, of chancellors and athletic directors. There are apparently faculty reps in the PAC-10, but their role is very different.
All right. How long do we have?
Well, I'm hoping to finish up a little more this afternoon. Could we go to 5? Would that?
Oh, good. That's
yeah,
fine.
Okay.
I was just watching this clock creep around at 4:30. Let's see.
Who is this?
At least it keeps time, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as the Chinese battery still works.
You mentioned fundraising. There's no connection except to do with fundraising. But there was just a little brief flurry, was there, of possibly taking some of the money raised in Madison and using it elsewhere for Milwaukee?
Somebody ought to ask Bob Rennebaum about that, because until 1981 or 82, first of all, the UW Foundation was the vehicle for fundraising for Parkside, Green Bay, Extension, and until about that time for Milwaukee as well. In fact, by agreement between Werner Baum, this is a very complex issue. I don't know how much you want to go into.
Is it written up?
I don't know. But Werner Baum and Ed Young had an agreement when they were both chancellors, which Ed continued into the time of his presidency, that a small amount of what I guess could be described as Madison funds were used for specific projects in Milwaukee. Now, that's one example. The only other one, to my knowledge, is the one Vilas professorship, which the Vilas trustees granted to Milwaukee some years ago and is held by Ihab Hassan, who's a complete person. So that, there is the Vilas trustees also provide a small amount for summer music programs at Milwaukee. Beyond that, it gets very complicated. Most gifts and bequests to the Board of Regents, to the UW Foundation, or quite often simply to the University of Wisconsin, period, are assumed to be for Madison use unless there is some evidence to the contrary. For example, occasionally you will get someone who lived in Milwaukee all of his or her life, was a graduate of the Milwaukee State Teachers College, and will leave a small bequest to the University of Wisconsin for, and then there'll be reference to a Milwaukee-based program. Mm-hmm. A decision is made in that instance that it was meant to go to Milwaukee, but the assumption or presumption, rebuttable with some difficulty, is that an unspecified gift or bequest goes to Madison. Now, as a matter of fact, before merger, some wharf funds
did go to
Milwaukee, Parkside, Green Bay, and even to the Marathon County Center.
Yeah.
As a result of merger, all the wharf money was limited to Madison. That's just a fact of life. But except for the one Vilas professor and the Vilas summer music grants and this residual relationship between Ed Young and Werner Baum, the last installment of which was paid after I got here, and it was used actually for the celebration of the 25th anniversary of UW-Milwaukee, which was in a sense a Madison function, historically, certainly a UW Foundation function. From that time on, there's absolutely no transfer of any kind. I think I can...
You don't think there should be here?
Well, I think, to be quite honest, the UW Foundation supports this office, our entertainment and so on, comes from a fund, most of which is from Madison alumni and friends. But in order to create a sense of system, every couple of years, somebody, not I, but usually the executive vice president, at Bob Rennebaum's suggestion, writes to the other chancellors, and their foundations do make small contributions to for the use of the president's office. Not much, but it gives them... Now, in return, I think we have... over the years, I guess it'll be about $15,000 that we have given to the UW Foundation for Madison use.
Who's we?
Karen and I, personally. We have given $500 to Milwaukee, $200 to Platteville, $100 to Whitewater, $100 to Stout, $100 to Stevens Point, I think. Again, feeling that a small amount should go to the others. That's obviously, again, something that I don't mind having opened up, and whenever it is, the archives will be open, but I just assume not broadcast right now. And that seemed a fair apportionment of what it really is honoraria and so on that I don't feel I can accept, so most of it I just turn over to the foundation. But I've also felt that a small amount should indicate our support of the other foundations. And that's roughly in the same proportion in which it comes in. Incidentally, there is only one sizable source of support which comes directly to the president's office, and that, interestingly, is from the Kikkoman Company. They grow most of their soybeans in... so there we were, somewhere between... the Aleutian Islands and Tokyo, opening a little packet of soy sauce on the Japan Airlines a week ago Saturday, and it came from Walworth County. Well, they've been very generous. And they now provide, I think it's $10,000 a year for unrestricted purposes. But that's the only, other than the UW Foundation, that's the only substantial income we have. In Virginia, incidentally, all that comes through the Alumni Association, including the car, of all things. Alumni Association owns the president's car.
It'd be hard to achieve here, I imagine.
Well, here it comes from the Madison campus motor pool. It's very interesting. The system administration has a fleet of station wagons and so on, but I suppose for historic reasons, the president's car is a part of the Madison campus motor pool.
And what about the president's bike?
No, that's mine. I hope I can get it back into the moving van before they lock it up tonight. That's one reason I have to get home. But I'm not aware of any other, use of foundation funds, but I also vividly recall the outrage of my colleagues at Berkeley when in 1969 or 70 a new vice president was hired in the system administration who had been a vice chancellor at Davis, and they bought for him this, never seen anything so much like a Venetian palace on dry land as this house on Gailey Road in Berkeley. And after buying the house, they spent something like $150,000 to fix it up, all of which came from Berkeley alumni and friends. There's great bitterness about that. I didn't have that much of a hang-up, but some of my older the old blues among my colleagues, really took that very hard. There was quite a protest. That wouldn't happen here. People, actually on those issues, I must say people are much more relaxed here than they were in California.
Just looking through, one of the things that was that John Ross raised, I don't think he'd mind my saying this, is the difficulty that they've had, that the Madison campus has had, getting figures from the system. And he is an example he gave for when the committee was working on faculty pay, when the university committee first set up a subcommittee. And they couldn't get what they needed from the system.
John never mentioned that to me. He never asked me for any information.
Well, I wondered if you were at all involved in this.
Yeah, I tend to think. Well, let me give what I think may be the explanation. It sometimes comes from not asking a question which is meaningful to a budget person. I will sometimes ask Gene Arnn, and he'll say, I don't understand. Or he'll say, we don't have that information. Then I'll try and we'll probe for a while. Oh, that's what you want. And we'll get it. It's just very difficult sometimes to translate those questions. Now, if I knew what John's particular problem had been, I think we probably could have got it fairly easily, because there are darn few figures around here that aren't a matter of public knowledge.
Yeah.
So that John Ross is no different from Matt Palmer or Kay Schultz. If they want the information, we just give it to them. And that surprises me. I think it must have been a lapse in communication.
He also spoke of a system-wide committee he was on that needed figures on retirement, and again, couldn't get them from the system.
Yeah, I think, again, it's probably a matter of not asking the right question.
Or not asking the right person?
Yeah. Are not really knowing what it is you want. For example, this morning, Bob Ellis, the system personnel director, was in here, and the question was whether I should take my retirement accumulation out, which you can do any time before age 55, leave it in until age 55 and then take it out, or roll it over to an annuity at age 55. There was certainly no unwillingness on his part to give me helpful information. But it wasn't until almost the end that I finally asked the right question. And I said, that formula-based benefit seems awfully low. And we went around that. Finally, to ask if I had in the beginning asked, well, what would it be if the payout began at 60 or 65? I would have got the answer immediately, but it took me the better part of an hour. He knows everything. Somebody asks me for an opinion.
Who is this, did you say?
Bob Ellis, the personnel director. Somebody comes and asks me for an opinion on a constitutional law issue. And I probably give them a lot of information, which may or may not be useful, because I'm not thinking in terms of that person's need. I think that's simply a problem of specialization in large part. But I would go on to say that I can't recall anybody ever asking me to get information from somewhere in the system files that I couldn't get, unless it was legally privileged. There have been times when a reporter would ask for a personal letter, and I would say no. And they'd say, well, okay, if you've got a right to, it's up to you. End of discussion. Figured it's better to be honest, and 98% of the time I'd give it to them, but there are 2% where it is, in my view, no more proper subject of public consumption than a reporter's notes, which I, as a lawyer, have fought to keep confidential. And I often use that analogy with the reporter. And that tends to end the discussion.
You don't think there's anything in this proposal of Tom Loftus to steer students, bright students, to under-enrolled campuses, do you?
Well, I think the basic premise is sound. We talked a little bit last time about size and so on. I think 44,000 is somewhat too large, but at the same time, I don't have any magic formula by which to reduce that size. Berkeley and UCLA never faced the problem because the master plan froze all University of California campuses at 27.5.
But this is a bit different, isn't it? If you this was specifically bright students.
Yeah, well, UCLA redirects almost 15,000 applicants a year, some of whom. Now, they're not, UCLA is not required to redirect randomly. And one has the sense that, well, it depends. UCLA has no undergraduate business program. So, in a sense, they automatically redirect the best of their students who would be interested in studying business. Because they don't offer it. One of the very few state universities that does not have any undergraduate business program. They go to Berkeley, which does have an undergraduate business program, and they go somewhere else. I don't know what Tom is really, I'm not sure he knows what he's proposing.
It sounds preposterous.
Except that he believes, as I do, that 44,000 is too large. He also believes, perhaps more strongly than I do, that some measures should be taken other than simply awaiting the natural demographic downturn to reduce this size. And apparently he also believes that in the process some of the cream as well as the milk should be taken off.
Well, that's the crucial statement.
Well, you remember Lee Dreyfus?
The logical way to go would be to put the cream here.
Yeah, and I think that's what most people would argue. Lee Dreyfus once seriously proposed that Madison should be an upper division or at least a sophomore up campus, no freshmen.
What do you think of that?
I thought that was madness, and I said so in my speech to the Bascom Hill Society in the fall of 1981. I didn't mention the governor by name. But for somebody who once taught some of the largest and most popular undergraduate courses on this campus, he should know better. I think he does. I think he had a marvelous capacity for trying out interesting ideas, often just to see what would happen. Mm-hmm. Well, that one got shot down, so he never raised it again. I think Tom Loftus's approach at times reminds me of Lee Dreyfus and the trial balloon approach.
What do you think of Tom Loftus?
I think he's a very bright, energetic, able person. I don't know where he sees himself going. He can't remain speaker forever. I don't think he'd be satisfied going into the state senate. But where that will take him, I don't know.
Is he a friend of the university?
Oh yes.
Completely.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any misguided notions of what.
I don't think so. I think he's pretty nearly as supportive a person as you could ask for, both publicly and privately.
What other legislators would you pick out?
Well,
that have been particularly helpful.
A point that Mary Lou Muntz appreciates, and I think I may have mentioned last time, that in the 83 session, a lot of what was necessary and helpful happened through a coalition of four people, of whom she was one. The other three were Dick Shoemaker from Menominee, who has recently, I think, tarnished the cause somewhat by his support of the eventually vetoed and unapproved physical education project for Stout. That created more animosity at River Falls than it did anywhere else, but I think annoyed, disturbed a lot of people elsewhere. Dick Flintrop, who of course is now director or commissioner of the Juvenile Justice Unit, was then representative from Oshkosh, and Dave Halbach.
You did mention him last time. You didn't talk, I mean, I don't think you had spoken of
this
before.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of this coalition.
But you spoke of Halbach as being disturbed.
Yeah, for whatever reason, he was, some people are more helpful in one house than the other. Halbach, for whatever reason, was more helpful in the assembly than he has been in the Senate, although he's still at times been helpful and supportive, and I think was crucial in cutting through some of the rhetoric about the salary issue. But in the Senate, he has a rather complex district. His own seat has been very unstable since he left it. It had for a time, who was the guy who was defeated in the primary by the chicken man last fall? Grzesinski is now in that seat. And I've even forgotten the fellow's name, who served not much more than a year. Don Hassenorl from Wisconsin Rapids, who's from Marshfield, who's relatively quiet. And then Marlon Schneider. And I think one of the problems with Halbach Senate seat is that he has to represent Marlon Schneider as well. So he's been somewhat more difficult to deal with than he was.
But he had been
in the assembly. He was one of the stalwarts. Yes. Hmm. Yeah, and it was those four. Now since then, some of the slack has been taken up by Jeff Neubauer, who was extremely helpful. He's one of the people that you really admire. As a Stanford graduate, grew up in Racine, came back to Racine, and is now in his third term, I guess. There are quiet people like Marv Rochelle, the senator from Eau Claire, who is almost unfailingly supportive, but doesn't make much noise about it. There is, running through particularly this session, a point that I think I made last time but would underscore, that if you had to build a coalition consisting solely of Madison area people and Madison supporters in other parts of the state, you wouldn't have very much.
Is that because the area people aren't very strong?
Well, in this session, of course, you try to build a coalition consisting of Spencer Black, Becky Young, and Sue Magnuson, all in their first terms.
Yeah.
And in seniority and so on, they're nowhere. And what support do they get from Dave Clarenbach out on one side and Dave Travis on the other? And then Dale Schultz is only in his second term, and then somebody else down south, but no seniority except for Clarenbach, who does by and large have his own issues, some of which are helpful and others are not. In this session, almost unnoticed, he put in that bill which may have been vetoed. I know Ben Lawton tried very hard to get it vetoed, which would forbid AIDS testing in blood donations. Now, ostensibly, that has nothing to do with the university, but when you think what it does to a university hospital or any large hospital with a heavy surgery caseload, in the end, the last few days, Ben Lawton was more upset about that issue than any which directly affected the university.
And you don't know yet?
I was in China when the vetoes came down, so I don't know. And we were not directly interested in that issue.
Yeah.
Ben Lawton was interested more as a physician than as a regent. But that's an example of a kind of a Clarenbach issue that may not only not be supportive, but in a sense is inimical to university welfare.
And how much of a help is Fred Rister?
Well, to the extent that he can be, I think he's been around so long that he's above it all in some way. But as much as he can, he certainly is helpful. He also as presiding officer.
What do you mean, as much as he can?
Well, the presiding officer can't be as much a partisan for causes as others can. I think that may be somewhat of a problem with Loftus as well, though apparently the speaker is better able to take partisan roles than the Senate president.
But that wasn't true for Mary Lou when she was co-chairman.
Oh, no. Joint Finance, that's different. Yeah. I think the president of the Senate, I don't know when it was that they changed over from lieutenant governor and president pro tem to president, but with that office goes a degree of responsibility that I'm not sure anyone else, any other legislator, bears, and I think that's something of an inhibition. Russ Feingold has been extremely supportive, and because the Senate has turned over fairly rapidly, Russ is now moving into a level of seniority where he can be extremely helpful. Gary George, at times, is a very bright, able person, and at times he will just drop a hint. A very subtle person, you got to get the hint. When he does so, it is extremely helpful. But his constituency and his role are sufficiently complex that he can't always be that way. Some new people. Barbara Notstein, who represents the UW-Milwaukee district, is extremely helpful. And in some ways seems to have gotten her legislative sea legs or whatever it is a little faster than the new Madison people. She was on the audit committee, for example. We went through that reserve balance stuff, and she was the only person on the audit committee we could really deal with. So there are lots of people who are helpful in different ways and different places, but so many of the people that I really looked to and depended on in the first couple of years are gone.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned,
yes,
if you open the 7980 Blue Book, you'll see only two familiar faces. And that's Fred Risser and Tommy Thompson, both of whom in different ways have been extremely helpful. Also, it depends somewhat on the issue. You get to collective bargaining, you're not going to get a whole lot of help from a large number of Democrats. You've got to depend heavily on Republicans. And that's where a person like Tommy Thompson was absolutely crucial. He really led the troops on the collective bargaining. You've got to get every Republican and some Democrats. The only way you're ever going to defeat a bargaining bill, and we did that, I guess, four times since I've been here, and that I may say involves great expenditure of energy, time, goodwill, and political capital. I don't question that it's worth it. It's just that it's a very wearing experience.
You said that you had less difficulty dealing with the legislature than you had expected.
Yes.
Last time. And I know I've talked to Fred Risser, who said that you went down a great deal, more than any other president, and that it meant a great deal to legislators. Did you expect to do that much?
I think I did. I expected that the reception would be much less cordial than it was. I'd just come back from Virginia, and we had a reception. One of the first things that happened after my appointment was announced, a reception for legislators who represent or are close to two-year centers. That turns out to be almost half the legislature, at least they'd like to be so identified. And I looked around the room and first thought to myself, and then I said to them, This is a group of friends. These are people you might invite to dinner, or you might just chat with on a personal problem. And that I had really not expected, because legislators in other states, with the possible exception of California, are not like that. And even in California, I found it much tougher. Of course, my role there was as law professor, testifying as expert witness on particular legislation. And I got some, I testified on obscenity legislation, I testified on insanity bills, I testified on anti-Vietnam War resolutions and things like that.
Can't have been as popular.
No, and I that was not an altogether happy relationship, even with the Berkeley area, the East Bay delegation. In fact, among the senator in whose district I actually lived was one of the most hostile people. Introduced a trespass bill that the universities couldn't possibly live with. It was passed in a slightly modified form. We really tried. Here I'm now talking from the John Ross point of view. When I was on the executive committee of the Berkeley Senate, we used to try to entertain the East Bay legislators several times a year, and that was no fun, even though we were faculty representing a good many thousand voters. That was tough. So I came here, and I must say it was, on the whole, with a very few exceptions, an extraordinarily cordial relationship.
I don't know that this, for one thing, I want to know if there are something or things that you would like to discuss. And I also have a question which I was puzzled as I listened to the last, first session, that you seemed to show a great deal of detachment, and your awareness of other campuses and other problems allowed you to look at this system and say, well, it happened this way elsewhere, and not so bad here. But at the same time, you clearly felt very deeply about the some of the things you had to deal with, most of them. Which prevailed, the detachment or the...
Well, maybe, I'm not sure I made last time this point.
Excuse me, how long are you going to be?
Oh, I think we said we'd wrap up about 5, I guess.
Okay, so. Because Cavalier Daily is called White.
Oh. Okay. Is she going to be there for a bit?
We actually said she'd be there till 5.
Okay. Let's try to call her
right.
Then. Okay. Occasionally a reporter will ask, "Gee, is the salary issue the toughest issue that you've dealt with?" And my answer always has been, "In some ways, I wish it were, but no, that's it was not." Not an easy issue, but it's far from the toughest. The toughest issues are all personnel issues. And now, having been in university administration for, full time for almost 15 years.
What are some examples?
Well, one night I had to participate in the firing of a black woman affirmative action officer that we'd brought all the way from San Diego, and then know that not only her own wrath, but the entire black community would come down on us. And it was not until I got here that the multi-million dollar lawsuit that she filed in Cincinnati was finally dismissed.
Oh, this is there.
Yeah, this is Cincinnati.
But what about
oh,
here?
No, I haven't had nothing like that. That's why it may sound detached. I don't mean to say that the last 5.5 years have been a picnic exactly, but by comparison to some of the problems that I faced in other roles, frankly, this has been relatively, very straightforward, relatively easygoing. And the same as I look at problems in other universities during this time. Because personnel matters. Tend to be, for one thing, no win. The best that you can hope is eventually that the lawsuit will be settled or dismissed or something, but all the bitterness and rancor and so on will go on and on for years. Second thing is that really nobody does win. Does the department that kind of timidly recommended tenure for somebody they didn't really want?
See, this is more the kind of thing that deans get involved
forced,
in.
Yeah, but it's unavoidable at the... Certainly when I was had responsibility for the whole campus in Indiana, I got a lot of these, and I ended up dealing directly with department chairs on personnel matters. Now, the system president did not. I don't think I ever sent... Oh, sometimes the people would go to him, but at that point he'd say, no, these are campus matters, all decided at the campus level, which is what I do here. And it's very easy on some terribly messy, nasty issues for a person in my position to smile and say, we decide those things at the campus level, and that's pretty much it.
Okay, we have, if I gather, about five more minutes. Have we covered? Is there something that we've left out?
And did you get a copy of my final reports to the regents?
No, I'd like
one. Yeah, we'll get those both today. What I tried to do there is two things. One is simply a chronicle or account of the last 5.5 years, touching on the things that I felt best about and a few that I felt incomplete or unfulfilled. The other is an attempt to look ahead and to answer some of these questions. Where are we going? Where should we be going?
Okay,
do we have a long-range plan, and so on? And there's nothing very startling in there, so unstartling, in fact, that as far as I can tell, only one regent has read either of them. But I did it as much for myself and for the record as anything.
Do you think any future president could wreck UW-Madison? I mean, I look at some of the candidates on the list, and I wonder...
Well, first of all, a person likely to be harmful or deleterious won't be chosen, so you can be sure on that score. I think the wrong person could upset the balance in either direction in ways that could be quite harmful. That's probably the most difficult and delicate part of this job, is maintaining some kind of reasonable balance, because at any given time on almost any issue, somebody will think that the balance is tipped. I'll just give one little example. The MacArthur chair, which is $1 million endowment from the MacArthur Foundation, was awarded to, I think, 10 universities. In the case of California, it was specifically given to the Berkeley campus, and all the communication was with the chancellor. In our case, and I think the same was true in Illinois, it was all with the Urbana campus administration. Here, for whatever reason, and I never knew why, the communication was with me, and the award was to the University of Wisconsin System. I was asked, no, I wasn't even I, it was Harvey Brusher, was asked, oh, where will it go? And the answer was, well, the regents have to make that decision. My good friend Tom Brock took that as an indication that maybe it would go to Milwaukee or Whitewater or something. Tom called when he was, or I guess he wrote, and I called him. I said, for heaven's sake, Tom, of course the MacArthur chair will be at Madison. But the technical answer is correct, that technically, since the grant was made to the University of Wisconsin System, the regents will have to designate not only a holder, but the location. But of course, it's ridiculous. Well, that's a degree of sensitivity that I certainly appreciate. I appreciate it partly because I spent 10 years as a faculty member at Berkeley seeing all those system problems from the flagship campus perspective, so that the enemy was not only in University Hall, the enemy is also in Westwood, much more so than the enemy here is in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind that in many respects, UCLA has actually overtaken Berkeley. Years ago in total budget because of the medical school, more recently in a number of areas in the ranking of individual programs. So that's a much more difficult problem. Thus the old blues who would say, as I think I mentioned last time, I will not use the initials UCB, there is no UCB. You don't get anybody here who says, I will not use the phrase UW-Madison, there is no UW-Madison, there is a UW. And then there are these other places. For whatever reason, it may be partly the passage of time. Most of the old blues have retired. There isn't, in fact, a corresponding phrase. One doesn't speak of old reds or anything like that here. But I don't even know that there's a concept that is comparable to the old blues, who were mostly themselves Berkeley graduates, and then went back on the faculty, spent their whole lives in Berkeley. And to them, they say the enemy was just as much in Westwood as in University Hall. That is in part endemic to a state university system. My own experience, I think, is helpful, if not indispensable, for a person coming into such a role. But it was also helpful to have spent that time at San Francisco State. And having gone, as I did while I was a Berkeley faculty member, up and down the coast to virtually every one of the state colleges, organizing workshops on law-related education and getting to know people there and realizing that if most of the first quality doctoral education was at Berkeley and UCLA, not all the wisdom nor all of the commitment to sound academic values was there. Two of my best friends, and on this I better conclude, with whom I served over a long period on the ACLU board in San Francisco. One was the chairman of the Faculty Senate at Sacramento State, and the other was a Berkeley, former Berkeley faculty member who had resigned over the oath and gone to San Francisco State. Actually, the executive director of the Southern California ACLU had once been a tenured member of the UCLA faculty who resigned over the oath. And the oath produced enormous differences in California. And there's, as far as I know, there was never anything comparable here that just drove people by the dozens out of the university. Well, one place you could go was to the state colleges, because they had the levering oath, but they never had the regent's oath. The regent's oath, thanks to Mr. Nyland, who was president of the Board of Regents, the regent's oath was much worse than state colleges. But that's David Gardner's doctoral dissertation, so I won't get into that. No, I can't think of anything that I would add. I think really we've covered the essentials, although there are a couple of questions in there that have funny reference points. And they don't ring bells, in other words, but I tried to answer them.
I'll have to check back.